Welcome to the Teachers Unify podcast. I'm Sarah Lerner. This episode features Robert Wilcox, Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which was created by the Biden administration in September 2023. He talks about his experience with gun violence, the work he's done with the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, and things teachers can do to make change. So welcome to the Teachers Unify podcast. I would like to introduce our very special guest, Robert Wilcox, who is Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I usually start with background information on the guests, like where you grew up and your childhood and all of that. But I would like to jump right in, if that's okay, to your work as an attorney and how that led you to your current role at the White House.
I'd be happy to start there. Although the truth is, I think my passion for this issue comes from well before that. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, between a couple of housing projects, and definitely saw violence in my community when I was growing up. But it was someone across the country who I was related to who was shot and killed. And that really brought this issue into a different light for me. I remember where I was when I got the call. I remember going right to the funeral. And I remember the horrible story of a beautiful young woman who was 19, home from winter break from Haverford College. Her name was Laura. And she was doing peace studies and a Quaker and brilliant and beautiful. And she was just volunteering at her local mental health hospital when someone, one of the patients who stopped taking his medicine and was armed and in crisis, walked in and shot her. One of the tragedies of that day, where there was others killed and others injured as well, is that his brother wanted to do something about it. His brother was a deputy sheriff. And he tried to take action, but didn't have tools. And so this individual was in crisis and armed. And I remember that funeral like it was yesterday. And I actually then at that point dedicated myself to wanting to never see this happen again, not just for where I grew up, but what I witnessed, that pain. But going to your question, I did that work for a couple of years in D.C. and it was hard. It was 2001, 2002, and 2003. And I could tell you the gun lobby, actually, I remember it clear as day. They had an article published where they said with the election of George W. Bush, they'd work out of the West Wing. And it was a tough time. They passed some really dangerous legislation. They were not making investments in the things that worked. So I did do the work for a couple of years with volunteers and survivors, but then I went off to law school, started practicing law at a law firm in New York, working on big litigation. And then that shooting at Sandy Hook happened, and I just recall sitting on my couch, but then all of a sudden standing up and moving to the TV as President Obama was talking about what we were going to do. And I felt this hope, not just because of what happened to my family and where I grew up, but at that point I had two young kids of my own, and I thought about their safety and their world, and I thought, wow, the NRA isn't working out of the West Wing anymore. We're going to make change. It didn't happen, and people made excuses. And so at that point, I left the law firm and came back to this work full time and started working at Brady, using my litigation skills, then moved over to Everytown for gun safety, where I really focused on policy, first at the state level, then federally, and just poured myself into that work. And what I can tell you is I was convinced we were going to pass federal legislation because I knew that the public was with us and our kids deserved it. And when we were standing in the White House in 2022, a lot of us, a lot of the folks who've been fighting this for this issue, it felt a certain way to see that it didn't take more Democrats to get that law done. There were still only 50, same number there were in 2013. But instead of four Republicans, there was 15, because we literally have changed the calculus on this issue. And then beyond my wildest belief, the law that I worked so hard to pass, I got invited to help implement as part of this incredible administration. And all of a sudden, I thought to myself, when I was in the Rose Garden yet again with my kids on my left, same kids that inspired me in 2013, and Greg Jackson on my right, I thought to myself, it wasn't the NRA working out of the West Wing. It was survivors of gun violence, thanks to President Biden, who are going to make the first ever White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention.
How old were your kids when Sandy Hook happened?
My daughter was born in January of 2010. My son was born in August of 2012. So they were 1 and 4.
My kids, when that happened, my son was in first grade, like the kids at Sandy Hook. So he was almost seven, and my daughter was three. And I remember, and I know I've shared this on the show before, I remember I was at school when the news came out. I spoke to my husband, and he asked if I still felt safe being a teacher because I had been teaching for a number of years at that point. And, I said, of course I do. Nothing like this is ever going to happen here. And I remember thinking about my son and all of those kids at Sandy Hook and all of those teachers at Sandy Hook. Fast forward 5 years later, I am at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School and survived the shooting there in 2018. I live 3 hours from Pulse, and I was 19 when Columbine happened. There are so many moments and pieces of all of these shootings, whether school or community or otherwise, that I think even if you're not directly a survivor, you have some kind of connection. It's like my mom knows exactly where she was when President Kennedy was shot. She wasn't in Texas, she was in Queens, but it's that kind of a thing.
What you just said really made me reflect that we are truly a nation of gun violence survivors. It doesn't matter if you grew up where I grew up in Brooklyn, or you were my cousin in rural California, or you were 3 hours from Pulse in Parkland, or you were just part of the community that's been affected by the trauma that you're living with and the fear that comes with it. And it's not just the people that are killed and we've lost forever. It's the people who've been injured, and with gun violence being one of the fastest ways to become a disabled American in this country, and the mental health toll that it takes on the loved ones and friends and community from every one of these acts of gun violence, and it's happening 40,000 times a year. So my biggest reflection is about that we are in this together, and like that pain from our past is what we just pour into our present to fight for a safer future tomorrow. That collective trauma and that pain, and seeing gun violence in all its forms, truly seeing it, the communities that have been disinvested in our cities, the silent suicide that happens behind closed doors, the intimate partner violence that is so much more deadly with a firearm to our kids, as afraid in schools as they are potentially walking back and forth or vice versa. All of that adds up. And when we see each other in this crisis and we see all these forms of gun violence together, what we can see is a movement that can call for change, demand change, and a movement that helps elect someone like President Biden, who has made a career of being an unapologetic champion for gun safety. He's made a career out of turning pain into purpose. And so, if you ask me about my reflection, one of my big reflections is he did not have to staff this office with me and Greg Jackson, two survivors of gun violence. I've had no experience in the federal government. Greg's had very little. That's not a secret. But that's what he wanted, was survivors, people not just close to the pain, but close to the policy, close to the solutions, and who are going to work. And I can tell you, we have worked tirelessly from the moment we stepped in this building. It is 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., and it is because we'll do every single thing in our power to save lives.
And I love that. And that actually brings me to my next question. Clearly, you work closely with Greg Jackson as co-deputy directors, and he is a survivor as well. How did the department come to be? Like, what's its origin story?
The president has been leaning into this issue for as long as I can remember. And so I just want to kind of start with, when I talked about those dark days in the early 2000s when the gun lobby passed, special protection for the gun industry, when it was hiding data and defunding research, there weren't many voices standing up against them. And you can go back and look at the votes and you might be surprised, but honestly, it was a third rail issue. But there was always one consistent voice who would call out the gun lobby, and that would be fighting for survivors. And it was then Senator Joe Biden. And he has been unapologetic in taking on the gun lobby and in fighting for the solutions we need, be it better background check, investment in community violence intervention, investment in supports for survivors, and banning assault weapons. Once he became president, after running on the most aggressive platform for gun safety, they just started taking action right away. And it was not just kind of robust executive action, more executive action than any president in history. It was also signing into law the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, the first law to pass Congress in 30 years, thanks to the president's leadership in kind of creating a pathway for progress. But I think that the president, what he wanted to do was accelerate all that work, executive action, since the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. So the vice president has made a career of tackling this issue. So he wanted her to oversee this office and really dig in. And I can tell you, we work with her and her team every day. And he asked one of his most senior longtime aides and brilliant policy mind, Steph Feldman, to be the director. And she also has a big job as staff secretary. And so she said, we need to have more than just me if we're going to really take this on. We need an office. And the president agreed. The president said, we do need an office because we need people doing this work 24/7. Because one of the things I think we've realized is that we can't just call this a public health crisis, public health epidemic. We have to treat it that way. And that means we need to rethink how we even attack it. And it means we don't just use one lever, right? Department of Justice or law enforcement. We use a bunch of levers. And so it's that approach, which we can talk about more, I'd love to. But that approach takes people with that energy, that expertise to come in and do that work, honestly, you know, 12, 14 hour days to break down those silos and make sure, as the president said, we are maximizing the benefits of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. We are coming up with new executive action ideas. We are building partnerships with state and local officials. And at his direction, we are building the first ever FEMA-style response to gun violence to ensure we are supporting survivors. And I'd be happy to dig into those four areas. That is the work that we do every day. But I think that, to me, is what's driving him, is a lifelong commitment to an issue, leadership in his administration, and the desire to do as much as we possibly can to save lives.
Yeah, I definitely want to hear more about those areas. But I mean, I certainly don't know President Biden or Vice President Harris as well as you do, although I would love to. But I do know that President Biden, before he was president, reached out to Fred Guttenberg, whose daughter Jamie was killed at my school, and she was one of my students, you know, in the days right after the shooting. And he listened to Fred, and he was able to relay his own story of loss from his own son. But just knowing that he listens to survivors and listens to families of victims just speaks volumes about who he is as a person. Forget how he's done as a president. So to know that he cares about this so much to create this office is outstanding. But I would love to hear more about those areas that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I honestly couldn't have said that better myself. And I think I probably got ahead of myself talking about the policy when honestly, what drives the purpose is the pain, just going back to it. It's the pain that he's lived through. It's the pain of the people he's met. And that drives the desire to have the purpose of policy solutions that will make us safer. Hearing from survivors, understanding the magnitude of this issue, I think has led him to take action, but led him to create this office. And then he said, I need you to do these four things. Because I can tell you, getting the phone call to see if we would serve our country is pretty weighty. It's then especially daunting when you wonder how you're going to do it. But he made it kind of straightforward. He said, I'm going to give you these four tasks and let's work on these and see the progress we could make. And so, you know, the first is implementing the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and his executive actions. And look, there's a lot in that bill. It was negotiated by Senator Murphy, incredible champion on this issue. But he also had Republicans and independents, Senator Sinema, Senator Till, Senator Cornyn. So they came together to pass this law. And it's remarkable how much there's in that law, but there's a lot to do. Like this law includes the largest investment in youth mental health in our country's history. $1 billion to hire school mental health professionals. Grant dollars have gone out now to 264 grantees across the country, universities that have training programs, schools that are doing the hiring. It's an estimate that we're going to hire and train 14,000 new school mental health workers to go to high need schools across the country. That is significant. I've met some of these students. They're getting stipends to go through these programs. And they've said to us, it is because of this program that I'm able to pursue my dream. And so we are doing the work to invest in people, invest in solutions. There was a $250 million investment in community violence intervention, but it takes follow-up. It takes making sure that those dollars are getting to the right places, making sure that we're implementing and that these programs are doing all they can. While at the same time, we have to focus on some of these incredible pieces that relate to gun safety, right? The $750 million that's going to implementing red flag laws. You know, we know that these laws intervene and prevent suicide, prevent mass shootings, but these aren't tools that jump out of the toolbox. They have to be taken out. So these dollars are going to help states states implement these laws. And we're about to launch the first ever national ERPO resource center. So there's actually going to be a federally funded resource center to help folks implement these laws in great ways. The second thing he asked was come up with new ideas. Let's keep pushing the envelope. And, you know, I think with our experience, been able to identify some, but honestly, we are open for business. So we need ideas of what's working, what's been successful, what we can take to scale. But to give you a couple examples of what we've moved on, supporting survivors is of the utmost importance to us. We know we have to get basic resources to people to cover burial costs, to cover those basics so that they can get to work of healing, which is, as you know, as I know, is incredibly challenging. But if we can't even cover the basics, like we haven't even started. But we know the Victims of Crime Act funds have often been inaccessible, especially by Black and Brown communities. There's been too many barriers. And so this administration, for the first time in 20 years, put forth a regulation to remove those barriers, to make it clear and easier for people to get this funding. We've also, because we know at the end of the day, heal people, so we have to pour in to those who've suffered trauma, those who are close to someone who's been hurt through gun violence. At the same time, we've just launched a whole big new effort around secure gun storage, because we know that is the kind of thing that we can come together around, because secure gun storage helps us protect teens who are in crisis, with 76% of guns and youth suicide coming from the home, accidents, honestly, school shootings. And they're not all the same, but the evidence that I've seen, it's you know, 3 out of 4 of these school shooters are getting guns from the home. Not only that, we learned that 1 million guns were stolen from cars and homes the past 5 years, right? So that is a critical intervention point. And so what we just launched, and there's more to come, I can promise you, is the U.S. Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, sent a letter to all the principals and district administrators across the country saying, hey, this is important. I know principals have a lot on their plate, but keeping our kids safe is of that level of import that we need to convene our communities as leaders to talk about this issue in a competent way, in a way that brings people in, not pushing them away. And the Department of Justice put out the most comprehensive toolkit on safe storage to help people talk about it, feel comfortable, because we don't all know the difference between a cable lock and a biometric safe and a lockbox, but we've tried to make that easier. And so we gave principals a toolkit. But that's just a couple of the actions. Like, we have about 80, honestly, across 16 agencies, because this administration is not just looking for one solution, it's looking for all of them. And when within the first week of us starting, the vice president and the president had a cabinet meeting where he turned to her and she challenged every cabinet member on what they could be doing to address this crisis. And it's why we don't just see incredible action from Department of Justice, but we see the Department of Labor's grant programs leaning in. We see the Department of Education leaning in, right? That is the all of government approach, because that is what a public health approach looks like. It looks like everyone leaning in, everyone pouring in to the places that we need to. The third thing he asked us to do was work with state and local officials, right? He doesn't want us to be kind of spending our time in Congress where there's some gridlock right now. He said, work with state and local partners. So we had the largest convening this administration's ever had in person of state legislators to unveil the Safer States Agenda, which is a 6-part plan for states that has a little bit for anyone. It doesn't matter where you're from. It's from the ecosystem of creating state offices of gun violence prevention to the investments you make in community violence intervention or suicide prevention or crime gun intelligence, to supporting survivors, to trauma recovery centers and VOCA funds, to responsible gun ownership, better background checks, and yes, taking on rogue actors in the gun industry, the folks who make ghost guns, right? These parts that you can put together in your home and have no background check, no serial number, the fastest growing threat in America. This administration leaned in and said, we're not just going to look at who's picking these up and trafficking them. We're going to look at the companies that are making, marketing, and profiting on them. And so we took them on directly. And the last thing that he asked from us was, he said, if a hurricane lands in Florida, FEMA will show up with best tents, food, water. But when the shooting happened at your school, where was the federal response? Outside of law enforcement, which I know was there, where was the mental health help? Where was the help for businesses? Where's the help for families? Where's the help for the broader community? And so we have leaned in his direction to form a multi-agency response team so that when there's concentrations in violence, when there's a mass shooting, things that overwhelm the system, right? This issue is overwhelming, but the things that overwhelm the system, we can show up and provide support to those local communities. And Greg, he was in Maine for like 7 or 8 days leading a response around the Lewiston shooting. And he had 100 federal officials with him, making grants to schools, getting loans for small businesses, providing mental health and behavioral health supports, like really leaning in to try to figure out where the gaps were. And in Maine, it actually was the deaf community. And so that is what the president's asked of us. And we've been, you know, here, as Greg would say, for 158 days. You know, we are trying to meet our marks on all four of those tasks.
I have so many things to ask and say as follow-up. But just knowing that Greg was in Maine, in the aftermath of Lewiston, I think what people don't realize or necessarily think about is how a mass shooting, any shooting, impacts an entire community. And it's not just in the immediate aftermath, it's years later. Like, we are now 6 years out from the shooting at my school, and we're still not okay. And, knowing that the president, the vice president, that they have tasked you, collective, to have this kind of boots on the ground task force is great, because I can only use my own experience, but I know how valuable those resources would have been here. And, we're a suburban, relatively, affluent, upper middle class community. And I think about the communities with far fewer resources than we have, and the deaf and hard of hearing community and the issues that they have already, it's wonderful that you have that arm of the department. So our organization was founded by me as a survivor, Abby Clements, who's a survivor from Sandy Hook, and Sari Beth Rosenberg, who is a teacher, not a survivor, thankfully, but a teacher in New York City, and has students who have been impacted by community violence. And the three of us were in Washington, D.C. for the AFT conference in July. And we had the opportunity to meet Secretary Cardona and introduce ourselves and let him know like who we are and what we're doing. And he was so happy to meet us, and definitely likewise. But I love, and I was going to actually ask you about this, but I love that he has reached out to the principals to talk to their schools and communities about safe storage. And I just think that's going to be something like such a small but necessary action that's going to save so many lives. Personally, as an educator and a parent, I'm very thankful that he's done that. And hopefully they will take his lead and actually reach out and do what is being asked of them. I want to kind of look back with you as a parent. What do you see as an issue regarding the pressure for teachers to keep themselves and their students safe from gun violence, both in school and out of school?
I mean, we're asking too much of our youth. We're asking too much of our teachers. We're asking too much of our principals. We're asking too much of our law enforcement. We're asking too much of our frontline community violence intervention workers. But when we ask each other all together, I think that burden can get a little less. To your specific question, what do I see right now? I see a majority of kids who go to school who are worried about gun violence. That's pretty clear. I see kids that are going through, drills at 95% of the schools, and we have very little insight into what the right kind of drill is and what's going to be effective and what's going to be harmful. I see a lot of teachers who have to think about where they're going to hide at the same time as how they're going to, get a kid to read. I remember when I took my kids out when they were young. I think my daughter was in first grade and my son was in pre-K. And I think we were out camping with some friends and kids were kind of messing around in the tent. And like I walked over thinking they were going to be playing like, I don't know, like zombie or something. And you know what they were playing? They were playing active shooter drill. And my daughter was telling my son, the shooter's outside. Don't move. If you move, he'll see you. And I was working on this issue, and that still took my breath away. So I think we have asked way too much of our kids to be survivors in a school or on the walk to school when what we need to do is provide them the tools to be successful and healthy adults. I can't commend you enough. And I know Abby, who's a personal hero, and you've lent your voices to such a noble mission, which is telling the story from your perspective and making sure that we see our kids and we see our teachers and we see the reality of the burden we've placed because for too long we've been unwilling to address this issue head on. I do think we still have a lot to do, but with this approach and this kind of energy that we have now in this administration, and we're seeing across the country, we can reduce that burden a little and we can share that burden because with investment and strategy and compassion, we can kind of ask everyone, what are we doing? And no one has to feel like they're the island all alone. And I think that is one of the most important things I think about in this work is we are all thinking about violence. No doubt, right? Like what we talked about earlier, I don't know how many rooms you've been in, but you ask who here knows someone they love who's been impacted by gun violence. It's like half, it's almost always half the room, if not more. Some places you're almost at the whole room. If we're all feeling the issue that way, then all of us across these different agencies or bodies of work have to be working in that same direction to think about who's most at risk and what are we doing to invest to make sure they don't commit acts of violence, but also how do we keep guns out of their hands if they are in crisis or they're a juvenile or they have criminal intent. So I think it's a really good question. And it's one, honestly, I think every parent can answer for themselves, which is, when they look at their kid, they know that they're either in danger on the walk to school or at school or both. And that is just unacceptable in this country.
I agree. So I have two questions that kind of stem from that last one. So I'll start with, has being a survivor changed how you view sending your children to school in light of school and community gun violence?
It hasn't changed how I sent them to school, but it's changed how I've moved. I actually took my wife to say to me, I was doing this job and my kids, I think they were still in elementary school. She said, "Why are you trying to keep all the schools safe and you're not doing enough in our school?" And so I immediately got on my PTA board and I got on my county board and I headed up our school climate and safety committee. And so I leaned in. And so that's, I guess, how it was different. This is before I had this job. And so I didn't just do the work in every town for gun safety, but I leaned into my PTA, into my county school system to put in place the things we've been talking about, right? Like, how do we make sure that if someone's in crisis, that information can get into the hands of someone who can take action? Because what we know from all the research is, after the fact, everyone can say they saw the signs. Either they heard someone tell them, right? The bystander problem, 80% of the time, one of the shooter has told someone, or there were signs. The most recent report from the National Threat Assessment Center showed that, like, the targeted incidents over the past, I think, like 10 years, 100% of the times people said they saw warning signs, right? And so we have to have those systems in place to get that information and take real action, intervene, right? Both to help that kid before they've taken any violent action, get them off that path, but also make sure they don't have access to guns. And, my sheriff, he testified just recently in my county that he thinks they prevented 3, 5, or 8 school shootings. He said just by using extreme risk laws because they took action. They made sure the guns weren't available. I think that's how I've changed. I wouldn't say that I've never, I haven't like prep them myself. I don't kind of, I think, give them any type of advice, but I really leaned into my community. And I think that's something we could all do. Honestly, I feel very humbled to get an opportunity to do this work every day for this president. But we honestly all can be leaning into our schools because it shouldn't just be our teachers and our principals alone, but us as parents can be leaning in to help this fight, to help this charge, to help spread these messages, and to help support those who are on the front lines, right? Like, which teachers really are. They see kids every day, they see things that parents don't. But that doesn't mean that they can't get the support of the parent community and know that they are valued for doing that job of both teaching, but also protecting. That's how I've changed, I think. And that's not that you asked me to give advice, but that's the advice I would give, is just to lean in and lean in and support the investment in these solutions and the investment in our kids.
I think that's a really valuable point because I know two members of our school board ran for the school board after the shooting at my school. One of them, Debbie Hickson, lost her husband, Chris, and Lori Alhadeff lost her daughter, Alyssa. And, Lucy McBath ran for Congress, after losing her son. So I think it's important that you brought that up because there are things that you can do. Something seemingly as small as the local level, which isn't small at all. Definitely, there are things that people can do to bring about change and to be involved and use their voice as parents, even for people who aren't educators or in the school system. I also wanted to ask you what your thoughts, either your personal thoughts or the office's thoughts about lockdown drills, active shooter drills, because there are so many different types. There are some drills that use blanks and actually simulate a school shooting. Others just have us kind of shelter in place. Does the office have a stand on this or thoughts of how to maybe change them moving forward?
I will get to that in one second. I want to go back to the point you started with, though, about leaning in locally. You talked a lot about Secretary Cardona's action and how valuable and meaningful that was to you. That was the culmination of a whole lot of local action. The U.S. Department of Education did not start this trend. It was started in local communities that started doing this across the country. So I can tell you, when the Department of Education looked around to say, "Is anyone doing this?" what they could see was schools, dots across the country, all local action. And that's what leads to big change, is all of that local action. action adding up. So I just want to say that because I think it's such an important point that when we lean in, it doesn't just necessarily affect our local community, which is invaluable. It builds to something bigger. And that's what we're here for. You know, when it comes to these drills, I can tell you, I think there's some good reports out there that people can read if they want to get information about some of the limited research, but very concerning research around these drills and the potential harm. That research that's out there has informed this office, and we are pushing to ask questions and get even more information, research, and potentially guidelines around drills. Because, you know, look, 40 states require them right now, so they're happening. The question is, are they trauma-informed? Are there guardrails? Are we making the decision that actually will potentially improve and save lives? Or are we just inflicting harm? I think those are real legitimate questions. And I think we need to, and I can tell you, we have been leaning in to make sure that we are using the levers that we have to ask those questions and get the answers. Because we shouldn't just say, well, 95% of the schools are doing them, that's that. When I think, you know, as you just said, that they look very different all over the place. And I think that is driven in part because there is no real national standard and there is not much research into this. But at the same time, there is real wisdom in wanting to have preparation. I've heard from survivors from Parkland who talked about how corner of the classroom was filled with filing cabinets, and there was a particular student who couldn't get to a safe place and she lost her life. I think we know that preparation is important, and this administration supports that. We fund that. We want people to take preparation and school design seriously. But at the same time, we have to be very careful with how we've introduced these concepts, training to students. Because if you look at any of the polling, when you see 60, 65, 70% of kids worried about being shot at school, that doesn't match the frequency with which it's happening. But it does suggest that we have normalized it in such a way that people are really thinking about this and fear full of this. You know, we will, as an office and administration, invest in proven effective solutions, evidence-informed solutions. And I can tell you, I am pushing very hard to make sure we are looking hard at the drills because they're ubiquitous. And we need to make sure that we're not doing more harm than good.
I think it's important, and I don't know if you're already doing this, to have teachers as part of that conversation. Because I can tell you at my school, we do lockdown drills monthly. And there are kids who take it seriously. And there are other kids who just kind of see it almost the way that they see a fire drill. And they're going through the motions. But because all of the students at my school weren't on campus that day because the last class graduated in 21, you know, they're kind of going through the motions. I know of teachers at other schools that have the drills with the blanks and the sounds and things like that. And I hope that if you aren't, that you consider having teachers as part of the conversation along with the important research. Because as you know, we are the ones who are in the classrooms with the kids doing these drills and calming them down and having those discussions before and after and taking kind of like taking the pulse of where everybody is afterwards. And also for those of us who have been through a shooting, either at school or any kind of, you know, community gun violence, you know, even when we know these drills are happening, it's still very, I hate using the word triggering, but it is very triggering for us. But we also have to maintain composure and can't have a moment because we're in the room with these kids. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And honestly, I will say I've thought about that. I think the choice of teachers who've been and administrators who've been through shootings to remain in the profession shows a commitment to kids that is, and I mean this in the truest sense, remarkable. I think that, I think you've made a really good point about, I think I kind of my answer at first leaned into some of the potential harms, but then it also, I think I said this, but I'll be more clear. Like on the one hand, there's the potential harms. On the other hand, it's the potential benefit. We don't know, I think, really the answer to either with certainty. But the third point, which was your first point, is teachers and students have to be part of the conversation because you are the ones living through it. It goes back to, I think, the whole approach of why we put survivors in this Office of Gun Violence Prevention. It is because we know that if you're closest to the problem, you're closest to the pain, you will have the best ideas on the solutions. And so like Greg, myself, the president, like we believe that the vice president, that is a belief, right? Like that is why this office exists and it's how it exists. So 100% teachers who are seeing this are a huge part of the solution. I was using, I think I was probably using research shorthand to talk about like the lack of not just formal research, but really any information gathering in a significant way about what's happening. So it's not just the like most formal version of this. It's like we need to be just asking the questions in a realer way and not taking comfort in, you know, a stat report out that says, oh, we did, you know, 9 drills this school year without asking the much harder question of what were the benefits, what were the costs, what were the harms?
What can we as educators and in a larger sense as an organization, Teachers Unified to End Gun Violence, what can we do to ensure that we have a seat at the table in these gun violence prevention spaces?
I think you have a seat. I mean, from my perspective, you have a seat at the table. But if the question is, how do you get a seat at all the tables? I think it's where we were, which is leaning in and leading. It takes, and I don't say that to say that there's more on your shoulders, but I think you have the solutions and you're seeing the problem up close. And so your voices in the conversation about what the policies we should be pursuing are essential. I don't think we get this right without your voices. You know, you should know that teachers, the president, obviously, and the first lady are massively supporters of teachers. And so you know, of course, that like those voices, your voices have a always have a role in this administration. But I think it goes back to that local work. I mean, how are we taking the big ideas and seeing them grow locally? How are we following through and implementing? How are we making sure that I think as teachers, we're asking the tough questions around, like if we see the big new grant programs that are rolling out, the investments that are happening, I think continuing to make sure that those dollars are being invested as they should be. Federal government can't be on top of everything, but you're in the school and you can see, like, are we investing in the program? Are the mental health counselors and social workers and psychologists actually being put in place? So I think having an eye on implementation is huge because we have to make good on with the tools that we have, as well as pushing for the solutions we need.
Is there anything else that you want to share that I didn't touch on?
No, I just so appreciate the work that you're doing with Teachers Unify. I think this movement has become such a rich tapestry that's filled with heartbreak, but is also filled with hope, right? That this isn't a movement that's just about looking backwards, it's about looking forwards. I think the leadership of Teachers Unify and your work has been incredible to help us get to the place where we are making progress, where we know there's much more to be done, but where I can guarantee you this office will not stop fighting until they force us out of here kicking and screaming.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to follow Teachers Unified to End Gun Violence on Instagram and Threads at Teachers Unify, and follow the podcast on both platforms at Teachers Unify PC.